She began to undress, and by the time she was in the tiny bathroom brushing her teeth, she had forgotten all about Rose Madder, the woman on the hill. She had forgotten all about Norman, too, and Anna and Pam and the Indigo Girls on Saturday night. She was thinking about her dinner with Bill Steiner, replaying her date with him minute by minute, second by second. She lay in bed, slipping toward sleep, listening to the sound of crickets coming from Bryant Park. As she drifted, she found herself remembering, without pain and seemingly from a great distance, the year 1985 and her daughter Caroline. As far as Norman was concerned, there had never been a Caroline, and the fact that he had agreed with Rosie's hesitant suggestion that Caroline was a nice name for a girl didn't change that. To Norman, there had been only a tadpole that ended early. If it happened to be a girl tadpole, according to some nutty head trip his wife was on, so what? 800 million red Chinese didn't give a shit, in Norman speak. 1985. What a year that had been. What a year from hell. She had lost Caroline, the baby. Norman had nearly lost his job, had come close to being arrested, she had an idea. She had gone to the hospital with a broken rib that had lacerated and almost punctured her lung, and as a small extra added attraction, she had been cornholed with the handle of a tennis racket. That was also the year her mind, remarkably stable until then, began to slip a little. But in the midst of all those other festivities, she barely noticed that half an hour in Pooh's chair sometimes felt like 5 minutes, and that there were days when she took 8 or 9 showers between the time Norman left for work and the time he came back home. She must have caught pregnant in January, because that was when she started to be sick in the mornings, and she missed her first period in February. The case, which prompted Norman's official reprimand, one that would be carried in his jacket until the day he retired, had come in March. What was his name? She asked herself, still drifting in her bed, somewhere between sleep and waking, but for the time being still closer to the latter. The man who started all the trouble, what was his name? For a moment, it wouldn't come. Only the memory that he had been a black man, a jiggity-jig, in Norman speak. Then she got it. Bender, she murmured in the dark, listening to the low creak of the crickets. Richie Bender, that was his name. 1985, a hell of a year. A hell of a life. And now there was this life, this room, this bed, and the sound of crickets. Rosie closed her eyes and drifted.
Less than 3 miles from his wife now, Norman lay in his own bed, slipping towards sleep, slipping into darkness and listening to the steady rumble of traffic on Lakefront Avenue, 9 floors below him. His teeth and jaws still ached, but the pain was distant now, unimportant, hidden behind a mixture of aspirin and scotch. As he drifted, he also found himself thinking about Richie Bender. It was as if, unknown to either of them, Norman and Rosie had shared a brief telepathic kiss. Richie, he murmured into the shadows of his hotel room, and then put his forearm over his closed eyes. Richie Bender, you puke. You fucking puke. A Saturday it had been, the first Saturday in March of 1985, 9 years ago, give or take. Around 11 a.m. on that day, a jiggity jig had walked into the Payless store on the corner of 60th and Saranac, put 2 bullets in the clerk's head, looted the register, and walked out again. While Norman and his partner were questioning the clerk in the Bottle Redemption Center next door, they were approached by another jig, this one wearing a Buffalo Bills jersey. "I know that nigga," he said. "What nigger is that, bro?" Norman asked. "Nigger robbed that Payless," the jig had replied. "I was standing right over there by mailbox when he come out. Name Richie Bender. He a bad nigger. Sell crack out of his motel room down there." He had pointed vaguely east toward the train station. "What motel might that be?" Harley Bissington asked. Harley had been partnered with Norman on that unfortunate day. "Railroad Motel," the black man said. "I don't suppose you happen to know which room," Harley had asked, Does your knowledge of the purported miscreant stretch that far, my brown-skinned friend? Harley had almost always talked that way. Sometimes it cracked Norman up. More often, it had made him want to grab the man by one of his narrow little knit ties and choke the Kokomo out of him. Their brown-skinned friend knew all right, of course he did. He was undoubtedly in there himself 2 or 3 times a week, maybe 5 or 6 if his current cash flow situation was good, buying rock from that bad nigger, Richie Bender. Their brown-skinned friend and all his brown-skinned jiggity-jig pals. Probably this fellow currently had some sort of down on Richie Bender, but that was nothing to Norman and Harley. All Norman and Harley wanted was to know where the shooter was so they could bust his ass right over to county and clear this case before cocktail hour. The jig in the Bills' jersey hadn't been able to recall the number of Bender's room, but he'd been able to tell them where it was just the same. First floor, main wing, right in between the Coke machine and the newspaper boxes. Norman and Harley had bopped on down to the Railroad Motel, clearly one of the city's finer dives, and knocked on the door between the Coke machine and the newspaper dispensers. The door had been opened by a slutty high yellow gal in a filmy red dress that let you get a good look at her bra and panties, and she was obviously one stoned American, and the two cops could see what looked like 3 empty crack vials standing on top of the motel television, and when Norman asked her where Richie Bender was, she made the mistake of laughing at him. "I don't own no wearing blender," she said. "You go on now, boys, and get your honky asses out of here." All of that was pretty straightforward, but then the various accounts had gotten a little confusing. Norman and Harley said that Ms. Wendy Yarrow, known more familiarly in the Daniels kitchen that spring and summer as the slutty high yellow gal, had taken a nail file from her purse and slashed Norman Daniels with it twice. Certainly, he had long, shallow cuts across his forehead and the back of his right hand, but Miss Yarrow claimed that Norman had made the cut across his hand himself and his partner had done the one over his eyebrows for him. They had done this, she said, after pushing her back into Unit 12 of the Railroad Motel, breaking her nose and 4 of her fingers, fracturing 9 bones in her left foot by stamping on it repeatedly. They took turns, she said, pulling out wads of her hair and punching her repeatedly in the abdomen. The short one then raped her, she told the IA shoe flies. The broad-shouldered one had tried to rape her, but hadn't been able to get it up at first. He bit her several times on the breasts and face, and then he was able to get an erection, she told them, but he squirted all over my leg before he could get it in. Then he hit me some more. He told me he wanted to talk to me up close, but he did most of his talking with his fists. Now, lying in bed at the Whitestone, lying on sheets his wife had had in her hands, Norman rolled onto his side and tried to push 1985 away. It didn't want to go. No surprise there. Once it came, it never did. 1985 was a hanger around her, like some blabby asshole gas bag neighbor you just can't get rid of. We made a mistake, Norman thought. We believed that goddamn jig in the football jersey. Yes, that had been a mistake, all right, a rather big one. And they had believed that a woman who looked so much as if she belonged with a Richie Bender must be in Richie Bender's room, and that was either a second mistake or an extension of the first one, and it really didn't matter which, because the results were the same. Ms. Wendy Yarrow was a part-time waitress, a part-time hooker, and a full-time drug addict, but she had not been in Richie Bender's room, did not in fact know there was such a creature as Richie Bender on the planet. Richie Bender had turned out to be the man who had robbed the Payless and wasted the clerk, but his room wasn't between the soda machine and the newspaper boxes. That was Wendy Yarrow's room, and Wendy Yarrow had been all by herself, at least on that particular day. Richie Bender's room had been on the other side of the Coke machine. That mistake had almost cost Norman Daniels and Harley Bissington their jobs. But in the end, the IA people had believed the nail file story, and there had been no sperm to support Ms. Yarrow's claims of rape. Her assertion that the older of the two, the one who had actually gotten it into her, had used a condom and then flushed it down the toilet was not provable. There had been other problems, though. Even their greatest partisans in the department had to admit that Inspector Daniels and Bissington might have gone a little overboard in their efforts to subdue this 110-pound wildcat with the nail file. She did have quite a few broken fingers, for instance. Hence the official reprimand. Nor had that been the end of it. The uppity bitch had found that kike, that little bald-headed kike. But the world was full of uppity, troublemaking bitches, his wife, for instance. But she was one uppity bitch he could do something about, always supposing, that was, he could get a little sleep. Norman rolled over onto his other side, and 1985 at last began to fade away. "When you least expect it, Rose," he murmured, "that's when I'll come for you." 5 minutes later, he was asleep.
"That slutty gal," he called her, Rose thought in her own bed. She was close to sleep herself now, but not there quite yet. She could still hear the crickets in the park. "That slutty high yellow gal. Oh, how he hated her." Yes, of course he had. There had been a mess with the internal affairs investigators, for one thing. Norman and Harley Bissington had escaped from that with their skins intact, barely, only to discover that the slutty high yellow gal had found herself a lawyer, a bald-headed kike ambulance chaser, in Norman speak, who had filed a huge civil suit on her behalf. It named Norman, Harley, the entire police department. Then, not long before Rosie's miscarriage, Wendy Yarrow had been murdered. She was found behind one of the grain elevators on the west side of the lake. She had been stabbed over 100 times, and her breasts had been hacked off. "Some sicko," Norman had told Rosie, and although he had not been smiling after he put the telephone down, someone at the cop shop must have been really excited to have called him at home, there had been undeniable satisfaction in his voice. "She sat in at the game once too often, and a wild card came out of the deck. Hazard of the job." He had touched her hair then, very gently, stroking it, and had smiled at her. Not his biting smile, the one that made her feel like screaming, but she'd felt like screaming anyway because she had known just like that what had happened to Wendy Yarrow, the slutty high yellow gal. "See how lucky you are," he'd asked her, now stroking the back of her neck with his big, hard hands, now her shoulders, now the swells of her breasts. "See how lucky you are not to be out on the street, Rose." Then, maybe it had been a month later, maybe 6 weeks, he had come in from the garage, found Rosie reading a romance novel, and decided he needed to talk to her about her entertainment tastes. Needed to talk to her about them right up close, in fact. 1985, a hell of a year. Rosie lay in bed with her hands under her pillow, slipping toward sleep and listening to the sounds of the crickets coming in through the window, so close they sounded as if her room had been magically transported onto the bandstand in the park. And she thought of a woman who had sat in the corner, with her hair plastered against her sweaty cheeks, and her belly as hard as a stone, and her eyes rolling in their shock-darkened sockets, as the sinister kisses began to tickle at her thighs. That woman who was still years from seeing the drop of blood on the sheet. That woman who had not known places like Daughters and Sisters or men like Bill Steiner existed. That woman who had crossed her arms and gripped the points of her shoulders and prayed to a God she no longer believed in that it not be a miscarriage, that it not be the end of her small, sweet dream, and then thinking, as she felt it happening, that maybe it was better. She knew how Norman fulfilled his responsibilities as a husband. How might he fulfill them as a father? The soft hum of the crickets lulling her to sleep. And she could even smell grass, a husky, sweet aroma that seemed out of place in May. This was a smell she associated with August hayfields. "I never smelled grass from the park before," she thought sleepily. "Is this what love, infatuation at least, does to you? Does it sharpen your senses at the same time it's making you crazy?" Very distantly, she heard a rumble that could have been thunder. That was strange, too, because the sky had been clear when Bill brought her home. She had looked up and marveled at how many stars she could see, even with all the orange high-intensity streetlights. She drifted, sliding away, sliding into the last dreamless sleep she would have for some time, and her final thought before the darkness claimed her was, "How can I hear crickets or smell grass? The window's not open." I closed it before I got into bed. Closed it and locked it. Crickets. Late that Wednesday afternoon, Rosie almost floated into the hot pot. She ordered a cup of tea and a pastry and sat by the window, slowly eating and drinking as she watched the endless river of pedestrians outside, most of them office workers at this hour, headed home for the day. The hot pot was actually out of her way now that she was no longer working at the Whitestone, but she'd come here unhesitatingly just the same, perhaps because she had so many pleasant after-work cups of tea here with Pam, perhaps because she wasn't much of an explorer, not yet at least, and this was a place she knew and trusted. She had finished reading the manta ray around 2 o'clock and had been reaching under the table for her purse when Rhoda Simons had clicked through on the speaker. "Do you want a little break before we start the next one, Rosie?" she had asked. And there it was, as simple as that. She had hoped she would get the other 3 Belle Racine novels, had believed she would, but the relief of actually knowing could not be matched. Nor was that all. When they had broken at 4, already 2 chapters into a lurid little slash-and-stalk thriller called Kill All My Tomorrows, Rhoda had asked Rosie if she would mind stepping down to the ladies' bathroom with her for a few minutes. "I know it sounds weird," she said, "but I am dying for a smoke, and it's the only place in the whole damn building I dare to sneak one. Modern life's a bitch, Rosie." In the bathroom, Rhoda had lit a Capri and perched on the sink ledge between the 2 basins with an ease that bespoke long familiarity. She crossed her legs, hooked her right foot behind her left calf, and looked at Rosie speculatively. "Love your hair," she said. Rosie touched it self-consciously. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing she'd done in a beauty shop the previous evening, $50 she could not afford, and had been unable not to spend. "Thanks," she said. "Robbie's going to offer you a contract, you know." Rosie frowned and shook her head. "No, I don't know. What are you talking about?" "He may look like Mr. Pennybags on the Monopoly community chest cards, but Robbie's been in the audiobook biz since 1975, and he knows how good you are. He knows better than you do. You think you owe him a lot, don't you?" "I know I do," Rosie replied stiffly. She didn't like the way this conversation was going. It made her think of those Shakespearean plays where people stabbed their friends in the back and then reeled off long, sanctimonious soliloquies explaining how unavoidable it had been. "Don't let your gratitude get in the way of your self-interest," Rhoda said, tapping cigarette ash neatly into the basin and chasing it with a squirt of cold water. "I don't know the story of your life, and I don't particularly want to know it, but I know you did the manta ray in just 104 takes, which is fucking phenomenal. And I know you sound like the young Elizabeth Taylor. I also know, because it's just about taped to your forehead, that you're on your own and not used to it. You're so tabula rasa, it's scary. Do you know what that means?" Rosie wasn't entirely sure. Something about being naive, she thought, but she wasn't going to let on to Rhoda. "Yes, of course." "Good, and don't get me wrong, for Christ's sake. I'm not trying to cut in on Robbie or cut my own piece out of your cake. I'm rooting for you. So's Rob, and so's Curtis. It's just that Rob's also rooting for his wallet. Audiobooks is still a brand new field. If this were the movie business, we'd be halfway through the age of the silence. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?"
"Sort of."
"When Robbie listens to you reading The Manta Ray, he's thinking of an audio version of Mary Pickford. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. Even the way he met you adds to that. There's a legend about Lana Turner being discovered in Schwab's drugstore. Well, Robbie's already making a legend in his own mind about how he discovered you in his friend Steiner's pawn shop looking at antique postcards."
"Is that what he told you I was doing?" she asked, feeling a surge of warmth for Robbie Lefferts that was almost love.
"Uh-huh, but where he found you and what you were doing there doesn't really matter. The fact is that you're good, Rosie. You're really, really talented. It's almost as if you were born to this job. Rob discovered you, but that doesn't give him a right to your pipes for the rest of your life.
Don't let him own you.
He'd never want to do that, Rosie said. She was frightened and excited at the same time, and also a little angry at Rhoda for being so cynical. But all of these feelings had been suppressed beneath a bright layer of joy and relief. She was going to be all right for a little longer. And if Robbie really did offer her a contract, she might be all right for even longer than that. It was all very well for Rhoda Simons to preach caution. Rhoda wasn't living in a single room, 3 blocks from an area of town where you didn't park your car at the curb if you wanted to keep your radio and your hubcaps. Rhoda had an accountant husband, a house in the suburbs, and a 1994 silver Nissan. Rhoda had a Visa and an American Express card. Better yet, Rhoda had a Blue Cross card and savings she could draw on if she got sick and couldn't work. For people who had those things, Rosie imagined, advising caution in business affairs was probably as natural as breathing. Maybe not, Rhoda said, but you could be a small gold mine, Rosie, and sometimes people change when they discover gold mines, even nice people like Robbie Lefferts. Now, drinking her tea and looking out the window of the hot pot, Rosie remembered Rhoda dousing her cigarette under the cold tap, dropping it in the trash, and then coming over to her. I know you're in a situation where job security is very important to you, and I'm not saying Robbie's a bad man. I've been working with him off and on since 1982, and I know he's not. But I'm telling you to keep an eye on the birds in the bush while you're making sure the one in your hand doesn't fly away. Do you follow me?
Not entirely, no.
Agree to do 6 books to start with, no more. 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon, right here at Tape Engine. $1,000 a week. Rosie goggled at her, feeling as if someone had stuck a vacuum cleaner hose down her throat and sucked the air out of her lungs.
$1,000 a week? Are you crazy?
Ask Kurt Hamilton if he thinks I'm crazy, Rhoda said calmly. Remember, it's not just the voice, it's the takes. You did the manta ray in 104. No one else I work with could have done it in less than 200. You have great voice management, but the absolutely incredible thing is your breath control. If you don't sing, how in God's name did you get such great control? A nightmarish image had occurred to Rosie then. Sitting in the corner with her kidneys swelling and throbbing like bloated bags filled with hot water, sitting there with her apron held in her hands, praying to God she wouldn't have to fill it because it hurt to throw up. It made her kidneys feel as if they were being stabbed with long, splintery sticks. Sitting there, breathing in long, flat inhales and slow, soft exhales, because that was what worked best. Trying to make the runaway beat of her heart match the calmer rhythm of her respiration. Sitting there, and listening to Norman making himself a sandwich in the kitchen and singing Daniel or Take a Letter, Maria, in his surprisingly good barroom tenor. I don't know, she had told Rhoda. I didn't even know what breath control was until I met you. I guess it's just a gift.
Well, count your blessings, kid, Rhoda said. We better get back. Kurt'll think we're practicing weird female rituals in here.
Robbie had called from his office downtown to congratulate her on finishing the manta ray, just as she was getting ready to leave for the day, this had been. And although he hadn't specifically mentioned a contract, he had asked if she would have lunch with him on Friday to discuss what he called a business arrangement. Rosie had agreed and hung up, feeling bemused. She remembered thinking that Rhoda's description of him was perfect. Robbie Lefferts did look like the little man on the Monopoly cards. When she put down the telephone in Curtis's private office, a cluttery little closet with hundreds of business cards stuck to the cork walls on pushpins, and went back out into the studio to collect her purse, Rhoda was gone, presumably for a final smoke in the ladies. Kurt was marking boxes of reel-to-reel tape. He looked up and gave her a grin. Great work today, Rosie.
Thanks.
Rhoda says Robbie's going to offer you a contract.
That's what she says, Rosie agreed. And I actually think she might be right. Knock on wood.
Well, you ought to remember one thing while you're dickering, Curtis said, putting the tape boxes on a high shelf where dozens of similar boxes were ranged like thin white books. If you made $500 for the manta ray,
Robbie's already ahead of the game, because you saved maybe 700 in studio time. Get it? She'd gotten it all right, and now she sat here in the hot pot with the future looking unexpectedly bright. She had friends, a place to live, a job, and the promise of more work when she had finished with Christina Bell. A contract that might mean as much as $1,000 a week, more money than Norman made. It was crazy, but it was true. Might be true, she amended. Oh, and one other thing. She had a date for Saturday. All of Saturday, if you counted in the Indigo Girls concert that night. Rosie's face, usually so solemn, broke into a brilliant smile, and she felt a totally inappropriate desire to hug herself. She took the last bite of her pastry and looked out the window again, wondering if all these things could possibly be happening to her, if there could actually be a real life where real people walked out of their prisons, turned right, and walked into heaven. Half a block away, Don't Walk went out, and Walk came on. Pam Haverford, now changed out of her white chambermaid's uniform and into a pair of trim red slacks, crossed the street with 24 other people. She had worked an extra hour tonight and had no reason on earth to think Rosie would be in the hot pot, but she did think it just the same. Call it woman's intuition if you wanted. She glanced briefly at the big lug crossing beside her, who she thought she had seen at the Whitestone newsstand a few minutes ago. He might have qualified as someone interesting if not for the look in his eyes, which was no look at all. He glanced briefly at her as they stepped up on the far curb, and the lack of expression in those eyes, the feeling of some absence behind them, actually chilled her. Inside the hot pot, Rosie abruptly decided she wanted a second cup of tea. She had no earthly reason to think Pam might drop in. It was a full hour past their usual time, but she did just the same. Maybe it was woman's intuition. She got up and turned toward the counter.
The little bitch beside him was sort of cute, Norman thought. Tight red slacks, nice little ass. He dropped back a couple of steps, the better to enjoy the view, my dear. But almost as soon as he did, she turned into a little restaurant. Norman glanced in the window as he went by, but saw nothing interesting, just a bunch of old bags eating gooey shit and slopping up coffee and tea, plus a few waiters rushing around in that mincing, faggy way they had. The old ladies must like it, Norman thought. Fag walking like that must pay off in tips. It had to. Why else would grown men walk that way? They couldn't all be fags. Could they? His gaze into the hot pot, brief and disinterested, touched on one lady considerably younger than the blue-rinsed, pants-suited type sitting at most of the tables. She was walking away from the window and toward the cafeteria-style serving counter at the far end of the tea room. At least, he supposed that was what you call places like this. He took a quick look at her ass, simply because that was where his eyes always went first when it was a woman younger than 40, judged it not too bad, but nothing to write home to Mother about. Rose's ass used to look like that, he thought, back in the days before she let herself go and it got as big as a goddamn footstool, that is. The woman he glimpsed through the window also had great hair, much better than her fanny, actually, but her hair didn't make him think of Rosie. Rosie was what Norman's mother had always called a brownette, and she rarely took any pains with her hair. Given its lackluster mousehide color, Norman didn't blame her. Pulling it back in a ponytail and securing it with a rubber band was her usual way of wearing it. If they were going out to dinner or a movie, she might thread it through one of those elastic scrunch things they sold in the drugstore. The woman upon whom Norman's gaze touched briefly when he looked into the hot pot was not a brownette, but a slim-hip blonde, and her hair was not in a ponytail or a scrunch. It hung down to the middle of her back in a carefully made plait.
Perhaps the best thing to happen all day, even better than Rhoda's stunning news that she might be worth $1,000 a week to Robbie Lefferts, was the look on Pam Haverford's face when Rosie turned away from the hot pot cash register with her fresh cup of tea. At first, Pam's eyes slid over her with absolutely no recognition at all, and then they snapped back, widening as they did so. Pam started to grin and then actually shrieked, probably pushing at least half a dozen pacemakers in the ferny little room, dangerously close to overload. Rosie? Is that you? Oh, my God! It's me, Rosie said, laughing and blushing. She was aware that people were turning to look at them and discovered, wonder of wonders, that she did not exactly mind. They took their tea to their old table by the window, and Rosie even allowed Pam to talk her into another pastry, although she had lost 15 pounds since coming to the city and had no intention of putting it back on if she could help it. Pam kept telling her that she couldn't believe it, simply couldn't believe it. A remark Rosie might have been tempted to chalk up to flattery, except for the way Pam's eyes kept moving from her face to her hair, as if she was trying to get the truth of it straight in her mind. "It makes you look 5 years younger," she said. "Hell, Rosie, it makes you look like jailbait." "For $50, it ought to make me look like Marilyn Monroe," Rosie replied, smiling. But since her talk with Rhoda, she felt a lot easier in her mind about the amount she'd spent on her hair. "Where did you—" Pam began, then stopped. "It's the picture you bought, isn't it? You had your hair done the same as the woman in the picture." Rosie thought she would blush at this, but no blush came. She simply nodded. "I loved that style, so I thought I'd try it." She hesitated, then added, "As for changing the color, I still can't believe I did it. It's the first time in my whole life that I've changed the color of my hair." "The first? I don't believe it." "It's true." Pam leaned across the table, and when she spoke, it was in a throaty, conspiratorial whisper. "It's happened, hasn't it?" "What are you talking about? What's happened?" "You've met someone interesting." Rosie opened her mouth, closed it, opened it again without the slightest idea of what she intended to say. It turned out to be nothing. What came out instead of words was laughter. She laughed until she cried, and before she was done, Pam had joined in.